From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. In this episode, we dissect America's teaching culture. Elizabeth Green talks to us about her new book, Building a Better Teacher, where she examines why we aren't better at teaching teachers how to teach.
Shh is actually the worst possible thing a teacher could say.
Also, we look at a study that shows heavy beats in music make people feel more powerful.
And what we found is that when the song had higher bass in the music, that actually made them feel more powerful.
And why the 1960s hit Farmer John was a cultural milestone. That's all on this podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West. Human rights organizations have accused both Israel and Hamas of violating the laws of war in this conflict. Human Rights Watch has criticized what it calls Israel's insufficient care to saving human lives. At the same time, Human Rights Watch has drawn attention to Hamas's own violations, the firing of rockets aimed at Israeli civilians. Last week, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called the shelling outside a UN school in Gaza a, quote, criminal act, and called for an investigation. But that's led to questions of who would lead such an investigation and where any such findings might lead. I asked Luis Moreno Ocampo these questions. He's the former head prosecutor for the International Criminal Court.
What happened in Gaza should be investigated. The UN Commission, for the Human Rights Commission of the UN, to investigate what happened in Gaza now. This commission has a bill to investigate, not to prosecute. So that will happen now. Normally, Israel feels that this commission is highly biased against it. In fact, in 2009, in the previous Gaza conflict, the commission was established to investigate crimes committed by Israeli forces, not by Hamas. But Richard Goldstone, who led this commission, forced the Human Rights Commission of UN to include the possibility to investigate Hamas. The problem is the only court ready to investigate crimes and to prosecute those who has responsibility is the International Criminal Court, and it can intervene directly in 122 national states which accepted the court jurisdiction. But Israel never accepted it.
I've seen you quoted that as saying that the Palestinians, if they were to do that, were to pursue that, they would open themselves up to risk as well when it comes to the international court. Could you explain?
Yeah, because when you accept the jurisdiction of the court, you cannot define who will be mitigated. That is the impartial decision of the prosecutor and the court. And therefore, if Palestine accepts the jurisdiction of Gaza, the prosecutor can decide to investigate Israel forces, but also Hamas crimes, because the rockets were fired from Gaza. So if Palestine gave jurisdiction to Gaza, then Hamas crimes could be investigated by the ICC too.
When we're talking about investigations, is that anything more than rhetoric, or can that actually lead to a prosecution in an international court at some point?
In the UN Commission inquiry doing investigations and then presenting the information to the Security Council, and at the UN Security Council, states deciding, okay, there are crimes committed here. Someone should investigate and make a judicial decision. So they refer the case to the International Criminal Court.
You know, you were involved with the Darfur prosecutions against Sudanese President Bashir. I know you've heard this. A concern that was raised was that by naming individuals, by prosecuting particular acts, that the court could set back, could cripple diplomatic efforts to end the crisis. Is this a situation where justice might be at odds with peace and diplomacy?
What is happening is the world was learning that negotiations, ignoring crimes, is complicated, is not helping to make agreements. Look what's happening in Syria today. It's not helping. And in fact, in Israel-Palestine conflict, we have 70 years of ignoring different type of crimes, and it's no agreement. So the idea that justice will obstruct negotiation, I think, is a wrong. It's an old idea from the Middle Age time. I remember one lawyer in Israel told me, look, we respected you. We believe that you were impartial. But for us, is not enough. Impartiality is not enough. He say, my children are at risk. I don't like to put the life of my children in the hands of an impartial person. I like a partial person, like a friend, to protect my children. And the Palestinians feel the same. They don't trust Israel. That's why I'm not sure if the ICC could be a solution, but I'm sure the solution is not just killing each other.
That's Luis Moreno Ocampo. He was the head prosecutor for the International Criminal Court for 9 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moving now to northern Africa. Today, more shells and rockets were exploding over Libya's capital, Tripoli. There aren't many positive words to describe what's happening in Libya right now. Assessments range from catastrophe to failed state. 3 years after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi, the country is being ripped apart by loose bands of militias vying for control of various regions. Libya does have a newly elected parliament, but they've been forced out of Tripoli and are convening for the time being in the eastern city of Tobruk. Earlier this week, I spoke with the foreign minister of the new parliament, Mohamed Abdelaziz. I asked him if it was fair to describe Libya as a failed state.
Honestly, the international community, instead of having a plan as a post-conflict situation for Libya, they left the Libyans to decide on their own. In fact, the job was not done properly. And instead of Libya going in the right direction, Libya went in the different direction, which, frankly speaking, almost 70% of the factors at the moment are conducive to a failed state, more to building a state. And this is the reason why we have asked the international community requesting more effective international engagement.
Do you believe that international intervention is required to save Libya?
There is a difference between intervention and engagement. We are not asking for a military intervention. We are asking for an upgraded and more effective international engagement. What we need is specialized training. We need advanced technology. We need advanced equipment. And we need really to have people who are capable of acting as soldiers, as trained policemen, trained prosecutors. We have to build our criminal justice system. And we are starting from scratch.
It sounds almost like there's a vicious circle here, because what you're talking about, that sort of engagement, requires a kind of safety on the ground, which is just not there in Libya right now. So how do you get to a level of stability that would allow that kind of engagement?
First of all, we need a very strong and effective political pressure on the factions who are fighting at the moment to stop fighting and to secure a ceasefire. Once the ceasefire is secured, we give a chance to the Libyan to enter into a national dialogue.
How do you get these factions to the table? How do you get them, after all this violence, to talk with each other?
We do suffer from the growing number of extremists, and some of the groups are very radical. We are responsible for our own destiny, and we are responsible for shaping our destiny. But honestly, we cannot do it alone. This is why we are asking for a more effective engagement of the international community.
You've said that you want engagement, not intervention. However, Libya's neighbor, Egypt, has raised concerns that what's happening in Libya could threaten Egyptian security. How concerned are you about what would happen if Egypt became involved in the conflict?
Egypt has the right to be concerned about Libya, but I would not expect that Egypt will intervene militarily in Libya, because this is, from my point of view, will not happen at all. What is really important for Egypt? To open its military camps for the training of Libyans, to open the police academy for Libyans to be trained. Intelligence services should work together in terms of controlling the Libyan-Egyptian borders to avoid smuggling of weapons and trafficking in human beings and illegal migration that we see it became the practice of the day. So I do believe that Egypt has a key role to play.
Today, militias in Libya are in control of heavy weapons like rockets and anti-aircraft cannon. How confident are you the government can disarm these militias?
Let me clarify one thing. Mm-hmm. It is very true, and we do recognize that those military groups are much, much stronger than the government itself. And I think violence will produce violence. the issue of demilitarization has two aspects. One is the political dimension, which that the warring parties or the military groups should really sit together and agree on a settlement plan and a road plan for Libya in which all of them will be included and engaged.
The process of disarming, if the Libyan government doesn't have the expertise or ability to do yes. that, who would do that then?
It's not the first time that the United Nations is embarked on a demilitarization process. I myself was in three peacekeeping operations before, and I am fully aware of the capability of the United Nations, you know, to undertake this exercise as much as demilitarization process is concerned.
So you're basically asking for a fairly robust UN security force in Libya?
No, as I mentioned too, there is the political dimension, which is our problem, that we have to solve the problem, that we have to reach an agreement on how to demilitarize these groups. And second is the technical process. It doesn't need a big force to demilitarize. We have done it in former Yugoslavia, I do recall. We have done it in Namibia. We have done it in other areas where the United Nations was fully involved in peacekeeping operations and peace-building operations. So it's not really new. What's important really to secure the political agreement of the military groups, the government, and the parliament to reach a conclusion on how really to go in that direction.
Mohamed Abdelaziz is the foreign minister for the Libyan government. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity, and I wish you and your colleagues all the best.
At a time when teacher effectiveness can mean losing tenure in places like California and New York, there's increasing debate over the type of teachers schools should keep or let go. Author Elizabeth Green spent time observing good teachers at home and in Japan. She says a big problem here is the pervasive idea that great teachers are born rather than made.
There's this assumption that you're either good or you're bad right from the get-go, that it must be a matter of maybe your personality or some kind of charisma that you have with the students. But in fact, when you break down what it is that teachers are doing, they're using techniques. And those are specific skills that we can teach people to do.
You talk about how some of these techniques are being used really effectively in Japan. So, say, in a math class, can you talk about how a Japanese teacher would ask a math question as opposed to what you typically see in this country?
One of the differences is the number of problems in a single class period. So in this country, we focus almost exclusively on answer-getting strategies, right? Ways to find the right answer. And so we have maybe 15 practice problems or even 20 or 30 in one lesson, and the student just tries again and again to practice the same strategy. In Japan, there's a single question per lesson, and that allows students not only to practice how to solve the problem and get the answer, but get at some of the deeper mathematical ideas.
One of the things that you write that's also worked well is mentorships. This is also something that happens in Japan where teachers spend time working on their craft.
Right. So another thing that holds our country back is that we have this culture of privacy around teaching. They spend all of their day only with their students, and they don't have exposure to their peers. In Japan, it's quite the opposite. They have this practice called Jugyo Kenkyu, which really turns teaching into a public science. So as many as 1,000 teachers come from all across the country to watch a single lesson and then dissect it afterwards. The Japanese teachers working together in this way have been able to decipher what is the best math problem for teaching subtraction with borrowing, you know, when the bottom number is bigger than the number on the top. And through trial and error and experimentation and discussion together, they've all settled on 13 minus 9. That's the kind of detailed finding that it would be really useful for American teachers to be able to work together to come to.
One huge hurdle that teachers face is the problem of misbehaving students. Can you talk about Doug Lemoff? He's a teacher that you write about who offered some advice.
The instinct for most adults when you're faced with students who are talking out of turn is to tell them to be quiet, right? Say, shh. But Doug realized that shh is actually the worst possible thing a teacher could say. It's very unclear. Are you telling the students to stop talking, or are you just telling them to talk more quietly?
You write how there is more shushing in American classrooms, and the Japanese classrooms sound practically raucous by comparison.
That's right. I went to Japan and expected to find robotic, drill and kill, obedient students. And that, you know, even the Japanese have that idea about their country versus our country, that the U.S. must be a place of incredible creativity. But in my book, I write about a Japanese educator who comes to the U.S. expecting to find that utopia and instead finds that all the teachers are telling their students to be more quiet. And there's this pervasive silence.
And something else that's odd is, as you write, that ideas that are being put into practice in Japan came from America.
Yeah. So the U.S. is like the world's greatest producer of amazing educational ideas, but we're one of the worst at putting the ideas into practice. We don't treat teaching as something that people need help learning how to do. So we say this great idea, but we just mandate it. We say, do this tomorrow and figure it out on your own. And that's really ludicrous once you understand just how complicated the science of teaching is.
Elizabeth Green is the author of Building a Better Teacher. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR West, and we are going to pump you up. A study out this week finds that music with a heavy bass line makes people feel more powerful. It's the secret behind pump-up songs. Adam Galinsky is one of the study's authors. He explained how the experiment worked.
We had a number of different individuals listen to a variety of different songs, and we just asked them to rate how much did that song make you feel power. And then what we did in our study is we just took three songs that were rated as making people feel the most powerful. We Will Rock You by Queen, Get Ready for This, Too Unlimited, In the Club, 50 Cent.
Go shorty, it's your birthday. We gonna party like it's your birthday. We gonna sip a
cup. And three songs that people rated as making them feel the least powerful. Because We Can by Fatboy Slim, We Let the Dogs Out by Baha Man, and Big Papa, Notorious B.I.G.
Okay, so then you asked people in the study to do tasks while they listened to either the high power songs or the low power songs. What sort of things were they doing?
So here's one of the tasks we did. People come in and they have an opportunity to roll a die. And if they get the number that they yell out before the die gets rolled, they get $5. So they're highly motivated. They want to win. You know, they want to get the right number. But we give them a choice. Do you want to roll the die yourself, or do you want the experimental roll the die? And what we find is usually, you know, a little bit more than 50% of people want to roll the die themselves. But in our case, when people listen to high power music, they wanted to roll the die themselves 86% of the time. And so what you can see here is it's making people sort of more action oriented.
My money on my mind, got a meal out the bill, and I'm still in the grind.
Is there a way to correct for other influences? Like, how do you know it's not the lyrics or the volume or something else?
Yeah, we could control for the amount of volume, for example, in the headsets, and we matched those all perfectly. We also then pre-tested the lyrics to make sure that just reading the lyrics didn't make people feel more powerful. But we did in our final studies, we said, well, can we isolate a bass sound? Because deep voices tend to be associated with power, and we know that bigger, stronger bodies tend to produce deeper voices. And so what we did, and we took a piece of music that no one had ever heard before, and we simply manipulated the amount of bass that was in the music. And what we found is that when the song had higher bass in the music, that actually made them feel more powerful.
You basically just cranked up the bass knob for the same song.
Yeah, basically just cranked up the bass knob.
What does feeling more powerful do for you? Do you do better at certain things? Do you have more energy and stamina?
Yeah, I think, I mean, all those things. People who have been made to feel more powerful can endure more pain. We've shown that if you prime people to think about power before they walk into an interview, they're like more than twice as likely to get, these were business school applications, but get selected into the business school than if they had thought about a time when they had low power. I think music is a really interesting one because music can not only make you feel powerful, but make the whole group feel powerful.
So individual application might be listen to Skrillex or some dubstep before a big job interview.
Yeah, one of the things I think that's real is what you want to do as an individual is find the piece of music that makes you feel powerful. It may be music that helps you do this. It may be the superwoman pose. You want to find the thing that works for you. But there's something out there that can work for everyone.
Adam Galinsky is a psychologist at Columbia Business School. He and Dennis Hsu have just published a study showing that heavy bass lines in music make people feel more powerful. Adam, thank you.
Thank you so much.
If you're an animal lover, zoos are a mixed bag. It's amazing to be in shouting distance of magnificent wild animals, but it's hard not to get the feeling that the great apes, big cats, and other creatures don't exactly love being behind bars and walls. Now, a Danish architectural firm is working with a zoo safari in Denmark to break down those walls and create what they're calling Zootopia. Architect Bjarke Ingels runs the architecture firm the Bjarke Ingels Group, or BIG. He's designing the zoo. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So you're known already for big ideas at BIG. Before we talk about the zoo, could you tell us some about your other innovative designs for buildings?
Right now we're building a power plant in Denmark that turns waste into electricity and district heating. But it's also made in such a way that you can actually hike on its roof. It's a giant public park. And in the winter, you can ski on it.
Nice. So why did you decide to take on the zoo?
For the zoo, it's almost a question of trying to find ways of actually creating a successful cohabitation between humans and different species of animals. We've done a lot of homes for humans. To get to work for new species, it would be a great challenge.
So this is in the concept stage right now, but can you describe what it's going to be like to walk into Zootopia?
First of all, to understand Zootopia, you have to understand that in Zootopia, there's only going to be social animals. You won't have a lonely tiger walking around inside a cage. You'll have gorillas, you'll have wolves, all kinds of animals that like to be together in larger groups so we can actually create entire habitats. And then secondly, we've organized it in such a way that you start by arriving in something that almost looks like a giant tilted crater. You can walk along the rim of the crater and get amazing views out over the entire landscape of Zootopia. And then from this crater, there'll be three giant gates that you can move through that will bring you into either America, Asia, or Africa. We have organized Asia so that you can visit it with water bicycles. You can bicycle through the area that is Africa, and then you can actually take a cable car through the area that is America. So essentially the idea is interfacing with the animals in completely new ways.
How close, though, can you interface with an animal like a lion when there aren't, you know, traditional walls and bars? I mean, how do you work that out with, well, let's talk through some different animals, like the lion, for instance.
You'll still be able to drive through the lion park with your car in the traditional car safari way. What we're basically looking at is to find different ways of hiding the barriers between the people and the animals. And in this case, what we've tried to do is to eliminate all traces of human architecture. So there are no buildings. You'll see rolling hills growing over the areas where the lions have to retreat when the winter gets cold in Denmark. And in a similar way, using combinations of level changes, trenches with water where the water depth prevents certain animals from crossing. In the case of the bears, your cable car might actually come really close to the bears above them, but it won't bring you within range. So you can say both the human experience and the animal experience is going to be much more exciting. I really do think that if you can make great zoos where so many different species can live in close proximity in harmony, you can also make great cities.
Look forward to seeing this.
Yeah, come over in 5 years.
Great. Architect Bjarke Ingels runs the architectural firm BIG. Thanks for your time today.
It was a pleasure.
We're going to stay in California for our next story and keep it retro. Set the Wayback Machine for the summer of 1964. New York and San Francisco saw the first big student protests against the Vietnam War. The entire country was infected with Beatlemania. And here in Los Angeles, the biggest hit of the summer was also a major cultural breakthrough. The premier's version of Farmer John would hit number 19 on the national charts. It was also one of the first mainstream rock hits by a Mexican-American band. And as NPR's Becky Sullivan reports, that made it a momentous twist on a classic formula of early rock and roll.
Before we get to the premieres, actually, I should explain that like a ton of other hits in the 50s and 60s, the original Farmer John sounded totally different from the one that blew up.
Farmer John, I'm in love with your daughter.
Don Harris and Dewey Terry were two black musicians who made up the R&B duo Don and Dewey. They wrote and released the original Farmer John in 1959.
I dig the way she walks, the way she talks. She really knocks me out. She starts me to shout. Whoa.
Now, the standard story behind a lot of early rock and roll hits goes like this. A black musician does a song, it's great, then a white musician covers it, and it's the white version that becomes the huge hit. Here's an example that's germane to this story. This song was written by the black performer Richard Berry.
Louie, Louie, well, well, me gotta go.
But the version you probably know is by a white band called the Kingsmen. The Kingsmen's Louie Louie came out in 1963. It was huge, and it immediately caught the attention of a 23-year-old Angelino named Billy Cardenas. Billy was an East LA guy, trying to make it as a record producer. He'd been trying to come up with a good way to redo that Don and Dewey song, Farmer John.
Farmer John.
Because I danced to it a lot, and I used to do a lot of swing dancing. And that was a song that was complete as far as its beat and swing.
But he thought he could make it even better. The Kingsmen's Louie Louie had a great guitar sound in this catchy three-chord pattern. So Billy proposed the idea of combining it with Don and Dewey's Farmer John to his newest group, the Premiers. Here's the thing. The Premiers weren't white. They were Mexican-American. And like a lot of early Chicano rock bands, they were just a handful of teenage kids. Two brothers and two of their friends. They'd been playing a mix of pop covers and traditional Mexican tunes at neighborhood parties in their east side suburb of San Gabriel. They'd gotten so popular there, their mom hired Billy as a manager. The Premiers liked the idea of a Farmer John Louie Louie combo, so the guys practiced the song for a few days, then Billy drove them to Hollywood to record it, adding in some canned crowd noise to make it sound like a live performance. He even put himself in this silly intro to the song. Billy had a good feeling about it.
You put in the ingredients, like when you cook, you put up all the ingredients, you know, and you hope that it's going to be a good tasting pie. Well, this was a good sounding piece of pie.
At the time, Chicano civil rights and Chicano rock were exploding in California. But this was 1964, still 2 months before Lyndon Johnson would sign the Civil Rights Act. For white performers, there was no trouble at all finding success in covering black musicians' songs. But Mexican Americans were having a harder time with that formula. Other songs like Tequila and La Bamba had been hits, but they were almost always either instrumental or sung in Spanish. Record companies just weren't convinced yet that Chicano bands like the Premiers could really play and sing in English.
First time I went to a particular record company, they told me, no, we won't even listen to it because we don't put Mexican records in radio. I said, it's not a Mexican record. You misunderstand. They play rock and roll.
But no dice. So the Premiers released Farmer John on a small L.A. label. Local DJs like Huggy Boy and Art LeBeau had huge Latino followings, and they played Farmer John constantly. Billy says it wasn't long before the big labels saw the potential.
Warner Brothers called to pick up the master. 30,000 records sold in the first week.
It took off. Less than a month later, the Premiers were on national TV on American Bandstand.
And this, of course, I guess is certainly one of the hottest records of the last few weeks. Ladies and gentlemen, here are the Premiers with Farmer John.
Farmer John spent over 2 months on Billboard's Hot 100, peaking at number 19. And it's lived on well after its exit from the charts. In the UK, a musician and artist named Billy Childish was just 4 when the song came out. He doesn't remember hearing it until the 80s. But even 20 years after its release, he was taken with it.
It's well played, well sung, well produced. Everything about it is sublime.
Billy Childish wanted to pay homage to Farmer John, but he didn't want to do just a straight cover. So instead, he wrote a song called Davy Crockett. It even included a tribute to that hokey intro that Billy Cardenas recorded.
Hey, Billy, if you see Davy, tell him Calamity Jane's looking for him.
There's no point doing a bad version of Farmer John when you can do a great version of Davy Crockett. Probably much like the producer who decided he might as well do a great version of Farmer John rather than a substandard version of Louie Louie. Because all you got to do is throw your own bit in the mix and you're away.
Billy Childish told me he thinks modern pop music is too produced, too obsessed with perfection.
Because when you hear things like Farmer John, you know that's what it was. Farmer John is impressive because it's not impressive.
Farmer John's progeny is definitely impressive. It's been covered dozens of times, from this Billy Childish take to a grungy cover by Neil Young, and even a Christmas version by the Sonics called Santa Claus. And its legacy goes beyond even that. Though the premiere's run ended when two of the four members were drafted and sent to Vietnam, their producer Billy Cardenas says the hit alone was momentous enough.
Farmer John was the beginning of a lot of things for Hispanics in East LA.
And across the country. The next year, Chicano bands would release the classics Wooly Bully and 96 Tears, and another even toured with a little group called the Beatles, opening for them at Shea Stadium. Becky Sullivan, NPR News.
I've got a familiar face in the studio with me now, a familiar voice to you out there, our friend, world music DJ Beto Arcos. And I can't think of a better welcome back to the West Coast than to have you, Beto, sitting in front of me with a stack of CDs. Good to see you.
It's great to see you, and it's always wonderful to be here.
So I was excited when I heard about your theme for this week. Tell us what you've got.
Well, I'm a big fan of the guitar. I play guitar myself, and occasionally I do sing, and even with my wife, we have a duet going on. And I think one of the best things about music is guitar and voice, and especially guitar and female voice. So I prepare this set of four guitarists and four singers, four female singers, because every duet that we're going to be featuring today has a different quality, a different approach to singing and to playing the guitar.
Nice. Well, let's hear your first song. This is a song called Claveles. Let's hear a little bit of that.
Tan rojos son tus claveles, cual ondas heridas crueles, claveles de hojas suaves, claveles de tus vergeles, que huelen como tú sabes y saben como tú hueles.
That is beautiful. Tell us who that is.
This is a duet from the Bay Area. The guitarist is from Mexico. His name is Jorge Liceaga, and she's American. Her name is Arwen Lawrence, and they have a group called Cascada de Flores, which means waterfall of flowers. And what they're doing here is they're interpreting an old Mexican song from the peninsula of Yucatan, where there's a great musical culture called Trova Yucateca. And she is singing in the style known as bambuco, which is a very, very African-influenced style of music.
It sounds very traditional. Is it just a retro take, or are they doing something new with this music as well?
They are reimagining, because the traditional way of playing and singing this one is not exactly the way she does it. But she is reimagining it. She is giving the song a much more modern, much more present, much more current quality to it. And I love how Jorge, who plays the guitar, meets up with her voice. It's just a beautiful pairing of the two.
Que entre tu pecho desecho muere un clavel cada día.
Next up, you have a collaboration between a flamenco guitarist and a Latin jazz singer. Tell us a little bit about that.
This is Magos Herrera, a jazz vocalist originally from Mexico, living in New York, and flamenco guitarist and producer Javier Limón. And what they're doing here is they're taking a standard called Nature Boy, mm-hmm, classic American song, but they are taking us a little bit into Andalusia with this beautiful kind of flamenco style called Solea por Bulerías.
There was a boy, a very strange enchanted boy. They say he wandered very far over land and sea. A little shy, but sad of eye.
So jazz by way of Spain, but still a fairly traditional sound.
It is, but I think what's interesting here is that she is not singing flamenco. Hmm. She's really interpreting her own way, but he's meeting her somewhere in the middle and creating something completely new.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Beto Arcos. He's host of the Global Village on KPFK here in Los Angeles, and he's brought a bunch of new music with him. Okay, Beto, what's next?
I want to play this song by this singer from Catalonia. Her name is Silvia Perez Cruz, accompanied by this fantastic guitarist who plays, in this case, the electric guitar. His name is Raúl Fernández Miró. And she's singing this song that is the poem by Federico García Lorca, the great Spanish poet. But it's the music of Leonard Cohen.
Huh.
The song is called Pequeño Vals Vienés, which in the U.S. it's known as Take This Waltz.
Porque te quiero, amor mío, en el desván donde juegan los niños, soñando viejas luces de Hungría, por los rumores de la tarde tibia, viendo ovejas y lirios de nieve.
Very passionate style of singing. It almost reminds me of some of the Balkan female singers or like the Fado singers of Portugal.
Absolutely. The thing I love about this singer, Silvia Perez Cruz, is that she takes somebody else's song and she owns it. Mm. She makes it her own song. And this is what she does, not just in this song, but throughout this record, which is just a beautiful album called Granada. And again, notice in this sound you're going to hear a bit of that kind of Sonic Youth, Nine Inch Nails, rocking guitar. I love this contrast of that sweet voice against that sound of the electric guitar.
Okay, Beto, we have time for just one more. What's that going to be?
This is a singer Kavita Shah and guitarist from Benin, Lionel Lueke. And the song they're going to perform is called Oju Oba.
É bonito viver, é tanto prazer que seu canto me dá. Você que sua luz, sua força conduz, a força é Oju Oba.
Now you notice she's singing in Portuguese.
Huh.
She sings in Portuguese, in Spanish, in English. She's a polyglot. She studied at Harvard University. But she's got this amazing dexterity with musical languages. And it's just like she owns the song. She wants to almost tell people that this song was meant for her.
It's amazing. I mean, she's billed as a jazz singer, but she seems pretty hard to classify.
Absolutely. I really think that what she's doing is something completely new.
I tell you, the Indian-American jazz artists, Stacey's, are doing well. Got Vijay Iyer, Rudresh Mahanthappa, and Kavita Shah is amazing.
Fantastic. She's a really wonderful. I'm looking forward to her next record. This is a beautiful album. It's called Visions.
In the studio here with me, this is Beto Arcos. He's the host of Global Village on KPFK in Los Angeles. Beto, it's always a blast having you here. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me.
For the week ending August 10th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday.
The production staff includes Priska Neely, Tom Dreisbach, Becky Sullivan, Daniel Hajek, Becky Hersher, and Denise Guerra. Our intern is Jen Velez. Patrick Murray is technical director with technical support from Arcia Caldwell. Muthoni Muturi is senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening. Thank you.